of all ideas.
And one of their preoccupations was the quest for social justice. And so out of the Enlightenment you have the French Revolution, and its Western branch, which led to the theories which on which the American Constitution were developed. Its Eastern branch developed into Marxism in the Soviet Union. And so one of the areas of social injustice that they saw was the oppression of women. Key things that one of the first feminist writers, the mother of Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, the woman who wrote Frankenstein, her mother wrote a book on the natural rights of women, and she pressed in there especially for the right of women to vote and the right to own property and things like that. The Enlightenment was followed by the Industrial Revolution. One of the things that happened in the Industrial Revolution was that they needed workers, and they had the phenomenon of women being employed in factories in large numbers. And they also had children working in these factories. So this was a social event that led to women coming out of their normal or their traditional domain of the house. And this was as they were starting to, the society was starting to develop past an agricultural society. We see this movement of women into factory production spurred by wars. So during World War I, there was something of that. World War II was a big jump. Most of the war industries were manned or woman by women, and you had these pop figures of Rosie the Riveter and stuff like that. After the war, with the development of the business machines, then you have women entering the white collar field in very large numbers, and still the dominant theme of the culture was that the main place that women should be is in the home, that their main social function was as wives and mothers. This was challenged in a very seminal work by Betty Friedan, The Feminine Mystique, which was published in 1963, became a bestseller almost instantly. And her main thesis, I haven't read the book, but from what I've read about it, was that men find their personal fulfillment in their jobs, and women are deprived of that, and the job of being a wife and a mother is stultifying, and that for women to achieve their true potential, they need to leave this narrow domain and be allowed into the larger society, and to seek whatever professions that they are interested in for their personal development. And this theory was accompanied by another major social change, a technological change, which was birth control, which was developed, I believe, in the late 50s, early 60s, the first birth control pills. So the birth rate began to drop in America and in the Western countries where these new methods were instituted. So whereas a woman in previous generations might have 5, 6, 7, 10, 12 children, we know that now the average is 2 point something. And when there is less time of a woman's life spent in childbearing and child raising, and that leaves more time, plus you have also the invention of lots of labor-saving devices. So there is less labor to do around the house, so there's more free time. So her treatise, or her book, was dealing with these social changes and suggesting that the proper way to deal with it was for women to leave the home and start working. Another major seminal book, which I think was published in 1970, it was by Kate Millett, called Sexual Politics. And this book really marks the beginning of a transition from what one writer, Christina Hoff Summers, she wrote a book that was published a year or two ago called Who Stole Feminism? She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont, I think.
University, Clark University.
Clark University in Massachusetts, right. She marks the difference between two stages of feminism in America. One she calls equity feminism, which was the feminism of women who were striving for the right to vote and equal pay for equal work, the right to own property, the right to divorce, you know, that anything that is permitted to a man, a woman should be given it in the same level. With Kate Millett's book, Sexual Politics, her thesis was that the whole history of mankind is a history of patriarchy, the oppression of women by men, and that this oppression is it is the central reality of social existence. And one person who took off with that theme was, I think her name was Susan Brownmiller. She wrote a book about rape. And her thesis was that all men benefit by some men raping women, because it's how men keep women in line. So, and there was a feature in Ms. Magazine called the click phenomenon, which was each issue, one person would tell their story of when it clicked, when they realized that they were the victim of oppression. And it's ironic in a way, because the people who wrote those things, and the majority of the people who now carry this banner in the world of what is called academic feminism, they tend to be, by most standards, very privileged white women from the upper middle class. And so the central feature of their ideology is this elevation of their victim status. And so now you have a peeling off of different groups who can one-up the others on who is being more victimized. So you have minority women who are attacking the privileged white women because they are more victimized than the upper class white women. And then you have lesbians who are attacking the others for being privileged in their heterosexual status, or in some way perhaps some people put it forward that the heterosexuals are in some way a traitor to their sex, collaborating with the enemy, so to speak. So there's different sort of splinter groups, and this has been a feature actually of leftist politics since the 60s, which is every little group claiming its status as an oppressed minority and trying to gain rights by highlighting its victimization by the dominant culture. This movement has become very powerful, especially in the university setting, and they've, since the late 80s, early 90s, there's been a tremendous amount of money spent and jobs created for curricular transformation. The idea is that women have been slighted in the fields of history and art and every field of knowledge, and that in order to set the balance straight, the curriculum has to be revised and teachers have to be retrained. This idea of, you know, removing the effects or the traces of patriarchy from the culture has gone to such an extent that they want to revise the language to remove traces of patriarchy from the way we think by the way we use words. So history is renamed herstory. There was one woman who dedicated her her book to her sisters in the woman's study ovular. So, you know, when I read this is a chapter heading of Christina Summers' book. So I read that and I was puzzled. What does ovular mean? It's the feminine version of a seminar. Okay. One of their the subjects which they which has undergone their scrutiny is religion, and religion as a tool of patriarchy for maintaining the dominance of men over women. One feature of this examination, which meshes with the New Age philosophy, is the idea of the goddess that men have promoted, a male god, and that Christianity, which is their cultural background, Christianity and the Catholic Church stamped out the women's religion, or the indigenous religion of Europe, and that is what burning witches was all about. That the Catholic Church had no role for women in any way, and these pagan religions, which had been in Europe before Catholicism established its dominance, that women had a great role in these religions. They were nature religions, and they used to worship the goddess. The great goddess is a recurring feature of pagan religion in the Mediterranean region under the name of Isis and Astarte and Sibyl and so many other names. So you see people with bumper stickers nowadays saying the goddess lives, and they call the religion Wicca, which is their name for what is called by us sorcery, witchcraft. Along with their attack on Christianity, of course, they have a lot of criticism to level at Islam. I'm quoting now from Aziza Hibri. She's a professor of law at the University of Richmond. She's from an Arabic background. She speaks... University of Vermont at Richmond?
Yes.
Oh. It's, University of Richmond is in Virginia. She seems to be born in an Arab country because she speaks English with an Arabic accent. And she, like I say, she's a professor of law. She said that she had been an atheist for many years of her life, and then she found her She found personal problems in her life which led her to search for religion, and she returned to Islam. She says, some argue that Islam is essentially a variation of patriarchal ideology. Others argue that Islam is above worldly ideology, including patriarchy. For as the word of God, it transcends all ideology. And then she goes on to say that, I'm just paraphrasing, that of the people who take that second point of view, they fall into two groups. One group says that Islam, as it's practiced today, is fair and just to women. Another group says that Islam, as practiced today, is utterly patriarchal, as opposed to the true Islam. There's a book called Middle Eastern Women Speak, and they quote an Algerian feminist named Fadila Mouravet. She has a long article in there which is somewhat rambling, but when she gets down to it, she talks about Islam and the Quran, and she says that it is unambiguously patriarchal. It addresses itself only to men. She quotes a couple of examples from Surah An-Nahl, verse 72. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. والله جعل لكم من أنفسكم أزواجا وجعل لكم من أزواجكم بنين وحفدة. And Allah appointed for you from yourselves spouses, and appointed for you from your spouses children and grandchildren. She says, this indicates that women are only here to be wives of men and mothers of their children. Another verse in Surah Al-Rum, وَمِنْ آيَاتِهِ أَنْ خَلَقَ لَكُمْ مِنْ أَنْفُسِكُمْ أَزْوَاجًا لِتَسْكُنُوا إِلَيْهَا. And from among his signs is that he created for you from yourselves spouses that you might find rest with them. So she said this is R&R for warriors. Another verse, Nisa'ukum harthu lakum, your wives are tillage for you. And health meaning, health is a word for that which is the farmer plows for growing crops. So that verse is clearly speaking to men. And of course, the verse of رِجَالُ قَوَّامُونَ عَلَى النِّسَاءِ. This is a verse we'll talk about in greater length when I get to another American writers among the feminists. This verse is translated as by Pickthall. I think he says men are in charge of women. Qawwamuna is a complex word with various facets of meaning. This verse, by the way, if anybody ever saw, there was about 1980 or 81, I think it was, on PBS. There was a documentary made by some feminist filmmakers, Americans or Europeans, who went to Morocco, and they showed a society that had deep problems. What they showed was really, they showed what was there, and it had some deep problems. The closing footage of the documentary was children in a classroom, and they have a teacher who is teaching them this verse, and he recites it, then they recite it, and they keep on reciting it and reciting it and reciting it as the credits roll. And the clear implication is that this is the means by which men are maintaining their oppressive dominance over women. And of course, there's another verse, Surah Al Baqarah says, referring to women, ولهن مثل الذي عليهن بالمعروف وللرجال عليهن درجة, and men have a degree over them. So she uses all of this as evidence that Islam is has a reactionary function in the world. There's another Egyptian feminist, Aminat al-Sa'id, who is quoted in the same book. She takes a more moderate stance. She's the editor of a magazine for women that was began publishing in the 50s. She says Quran gave women the following rights: economic independence, half of a man's share in inheritance, and in exchange he's required to maintain her. A minimum age of marriage set at puberty, leaving the interpretation of what puberty is to the society, which is, I don't know where she got that from, because the verse which talks about the idda says that the normal idda is three menstrual periods, but for women who are in menopause, that it's 3 months, and also for that started menstruating. Which indicates the permissibility of marrying them before puberty. The right to education. This, I suppose, is based on the hadith, طَلَبُ الْعِلْمِ فَرِيضَةٌ عَلَى كُلِّ مُسْلِمٍ. The seeking of knowledge is an obligation on every Muslim. And if I'm not mistaken, the version of it that most people quote, where they add Muslima, is not in the wording of the hadith, although it's clearly implicated by other evidence. There's a hadith where the Prophet ﷺ said that one woman would take 4 men to hell. Her deeds would be presented before Allah on the Day of Judgment. She would be found lacking, and He would order her to be taken to hell. And then she would cry out that my father, my brother, my husband, and my son, they all knew what they should be doing, and they never taught me. She goes on to say, the right to work, to be involved in trade and commerce, to own property, to sell and buy without influence of a man. I guess she's getting that from the verse that says لِلْرِجَالِ نَصِيبٌ مِّن مَكْتَسَبُ وَلِلْنِسَاءِ نَصِيبٌ مِّن مَكْتَسَبُ. For men is the portion of what they earn, and for women portion of what they earn. And the word اكتسب has two facets of meaning. One is the economic earning, and the other is the deeds that you earn. She says the right to participate in dealing with worldly and religious affairs. I suppose that the evidence that she's referring to in this is what Aziza Hibri uses as a dalil, that Surah Al-Mumtahina mentions that says when women come to give you the pledge of allegiance, the bay'ah, that take the bay'ah from them on the basis of their not worshipping anybody but Allah, and that they will not steal, nor kill, nor kill their children, they will not kill their children, nor will they invent a slander, which some scholars say that means attributing a child to their husband who's not really his child, and that they would not disobey the Prophet ﷺ in al-ma'ruf, that which is widely recognized as good or proper. So the bay'ah is fundamentally a political act, although all of these duties that are mentioned in it tend to relate to personal activities. But the word Be'a has a strong political implication. Okay, and number seven, the right to choose her own husband. And this is an example of something that the feminists have a great ground to stand on when they talk about the difference between Sharia and Fiqh, because the evidence is overwhelming that a woman or a girl may not be pressured into marrying somebody against her will. And yet, you have a number of the madhahib trying to explain away these very many hadith and giving the father the right to force his daughter to marry even against her will if she's a virgin. And this is a proper grounds for criticism of a patriarchal attitude, that people bring their attitudes with them when they interpret the Quran and the Sunnah. But we'll get to that in a minute. There's a methodology that we need to follow in order to protect ourselves from errors in that. Finally, in that book, there's a woman named, I think it's her name is Radda Samman, Lebanese. She was interviewed by a Lebanese newspaper, and her language is very rhetorical. Two excerpts from it. She was asked about marriage, and she said, "Marriage is in my country a kind of human prostitution legitimized by two witnesses and a legal document." She was asked about, does she think that that it's right to bring moral judgment to sexual conduct? And she talked about how the ideas of right and wrong vary from one culture to another. For an Eskimo, is considered hospitality to offer his wife to a guest. And so she says, "It's wrong," this is a quote, "it's wrong to assign absolute value to the moral concepts of any period." So there's a spectrum of reactions, you know, to feminism, and a spectrum of reactions to the Quran and to Islam under the impact of feminist thought. Some of the things that are clearly not a desirable thing, and they're not from Islam, which we see widespread today, or at least present among Muslims. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, illiteracy. The percent of illiteracy in many Muslim countries is high for both sexes, but it's almost always about twice as high for women as it is for men. A particularly troubling phenomenon or development associated with this is, if the reports are accurate, and it seems that they are, the Taliban movement, which is highly suspect in Afghanistan. They came out of nowhere. They're obviously supported by Pakistani army and intelligence, and these guys are supposed to be students in madrasas, and that's where they were during the war against the Russians, and now they suddenly show up with planes and tanks, and they control two-thirds of the country. Where they have taken power, they've made it illegal for women to go to school, for girls to go to school, and illegal for women to work outside the house. And you know, in connection with this, there's a book by the Islamic Text Society. I forget the author's name. I think his name is Siddiqui. It's about hadith, and he has an appendix in the end of the book where he talks about the role of women in the study of hadith in the past. It's quite interesting. He takes evidence from books of tabaqat. There was various scholars throughout the ages that would write biographies of famous people, and sometimes more specifically just of scholars. Wafayat al-Ayan by Ibn al-Khalaqan, Ad-Daw al-Lami' by Ibn al-Hajr, a number of books, Tabaqat ibn al-Sa'ad. And he demonstrates in there that there was just a long history of women who were hadith scholars, and they studied hadith from women, and they also studied it from men, and they had men among their students and women among their students. The details of how that took place and what their how they taught or how the were the sexes segregated, could the student, the male student, see the teacher, that's not mentioned at all in that. But they're, they represent about 10% of the scholars of any era until about 3 or 4 centuries ago. And then the books of Tarajum that talk about Islamic scholars, you don't find women mentioned hardly at all after about the 13th century Christian era. Okay, another prominent part of many cultures in the Middle East, I won't say prominent, but it's there, is called the ghusl al-'ar, washing away the shame or the dishonor. This is a social custom where if a girl in the family is suspected of having had sex before marriage or outside of marriage, that it's the duty of her brother or her father or her husband or whoever to kill her in order to avenge the honor. And this was mentioned, or it was presented in a movie, Turkish movie called Zul. I went to see it because it was like 1982 or something. It was the first time I ever saw credits that had Muslims' names in the title. And it turns out that the director was a communist. In that, he has one of the segments is about, it's about these people, men who get out of prison and what happens to them afterwards. One man comes back and he's told that his wife had been with somebody while he was in prison. And so he takes her out for a walk in the snow. And when she can no longer walk, he carries her on his back. And then when he's exhausted, he puts her down and she's exhausted so that she can't walk anymore. And he leaves her to freeze to death. Obviously, this has absolutely nothing to do with Islam. Again, forced marriage, that's something which is forbidden. Another feature that you see from Afghanistan, I know, the father takes the mahar. The mahar is a gift to the wife. It's not for her father. But you see frequently that the father gets it, and the girl is supposedly giving it of her free will, and that's ridiculous. Another thing that was shown in that television documentary I mentioned was that on the wedding night, relatives of the bride and groom, they wait outside the window where the marriage is to be consummated. And after the act, the husband opens the window and he throws out a sheet on which they perform the act, and if there's blood on it, then everybody shouts and whoops, and they tie it to a stick and they parade through the town demonstrating that the girl was a virgin. And if it wasn't, had no blood on it, then he'll send her home to her family. Another thing, which is obviously there's no textual evidence for it, is women not driving, which is the law in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi scholars explain that as sadd al-dharaya, blocking the paths for evil, or nipping evil in the bud. And they say it might be that her car would break down and then somebody would bother her. Or maybe that by being driving themselves, then that encourages them to leave the house and they really shouldn't. The alternative that men have devised in that society is that they bring chauffeurs from overseas, and so their daughter or their wife is alone in a car with a ghayr mahram man. So the wisdom of this policy is highly debatable. Okay, another thing that you see in the books of fiqh is the statement that a woman is not allowed to leave the house without her husband's permission. And they usually quote a hadith or two to back them up. And one that they quote, which is reported by Al-Hakim and Al-Bayhaqi and As-Sunan Al-Kubra, it says it's not permitted for a woman to allow a man, to allow anyone into her husband's house whom he dislikes. That part of the hadith is mentioned in many authentic hadith. This is something you find also in hadith which are fabricated, are that the first, they'll put something in the hadith that will be recognizable and well known from other sources, and then they'll slip something else in which is from themselves. So the second part of the hadith says that it's not permitted for her to leave the house without her husband's permission. And Al-Zahabi said about this hadith that it is munkar. It's munqati'. It's reported by Abba al-Khurasani, who he's in the Isnad, and he's Yarwil Manakir. There's a couple of others mentioned by Tabarani and some of the less famous books of hadith, at least two of which Sheikh al-Albani in his book Silsilat al-Hadith al-Da'if al-Mawdu'a, he declared both of those hadiths to be fabricated. And there was some other hadith that was used as evidence for that in either hadith or asr, I forget now, in the book Manar al-Sabil, which is a fairly recent book of Hanbali fiqh, written in the 50s by a Saudi scholar. And again, Al-Albani in his book Irwal al-Ghalil, he showed that these athar or hadith were weak. Although there can be a general encouragement for women staying in the house or asking their husband's permission from the general hadith which require her to be obedient to her husband. To talk about some of the prominent women du'aat in America, Muslim women, the best that I've come across or heard is Amina Silmi. I've only heard one tape of hers, which was Islam as a Means for Women's Liberation or something like that, that was a talk that she had given to a mostly a non-Muslim audience at a college town, I think in Kansas, And she comes at it as a feminist, and she says that she talked about various features of European culture where women were, their rights were taken away. And in the course of it, she talked about hijab. She mentioned that when she first accepted Islam, she told them, you know, I've accepted Islam, but two things: I will never wear a hijab, and if my husband takes another wife, I'll castrate him. So she came to change her opinion on both of those things by later reading. I mean, this is in line with, you know, the verse قالت الأعراب آمنا قل لم تؤمنوا ولكن قولوا أسلمنا ولما يدخل الإيمان في قلوبكم. The Bedouin Arabs claim, we have believed. Say, O Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, you have not believed. Rather, say, O you Arabs, or you Bedouins, say that we have entered into Islam because the faith has not yet entered your hearts. So, you know, it takes time to accept certain things by studying them. So she went on to defend hijab as her right, that it protects her from the inquiring eyes of others, and it makes the evaluation of the woman not, it removes her the dimension of sexual object from the evaluation of the woman, and it becomes a matter of personality that is the basis for evaluation. And she also went on to defend polygamy for the various reasons that you're probably familiar with. Some of the worst are Karima Omo, who she used to write for Islamic Horizons, and she was a convert to Islam, married to a Pakistani man, I believe. She became a follower of Rashad Khalifa, and you know that Rashad Khalifa rejects the Sunnah utterly. He said that the Quran is from Allah, it's proof that it's from Allah because of the prevalence of the number 19 as a numerical pattern in it, and that the Sunnah doesn't have this pattern, therefore the Sunnah is from Shaytan. And he had a lot of women who followed him because he said that you don't have to wear hijab, and women can lead salat and many things. Karima Omar, in talking about hadith, she talks about a hadith like the statement of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam reported by Tirmidhi, Ahmad, and others. The hadith is sahih. This is reported by, in various versions, by about five different sahaba, including Aisha, although that particular isnad is weak. But this hadith says, لو كنت آمرا أحدا أن يسجد لأحد لأمرت المرأة أن تسجد لزوجها لعظم حقه عليها. If I were to order anyone to prostrate to anyone, I would have ordered women to prostrate to their husbands because of the enormity of his right upon her. And the incident that spurred this was the Prophet ﷺ entering a corral where two camels were fighting, and when he entered, they quieted down and they both fell down on their knees facing him. And the Sahaba said, if these animals are prostrating to you, then why don't you let us prostrate to you? And he said, it's not permitted for anybody to prostrate to anybody. Prostration is only for Allah. Then he went on to say that. She said that this is obviously a fabrication by a patriarchal man. Although the isnad is authentic, I mean, hadith methodology doesn't matter for these people. I mean, if the content of the hadith doesn't match their inclinations, then it cannot be true. Another hadith that she had a comment about was the hadith of At-Tirmidhi, that it's one of many hadith that say that if a man calls his wife to bed, that she is obligated to respond. And the version of At-Tirmidhi says even if she were putting something in the oven or baking bread or something like that. And she said this was obviously fabricated by some sex-starved man. She has kind of fallen out of circulation. She doesn't get published much anymore, or maybe I'm just not reading her. But it's Harvard's decision as to who to employ. So this is the kind of people they're employing to teach us about Islam. Another person who has similar points of view is Kawkab al-Siddiqi. He started a group called Jama'at al-Muslimin. He split off from ISNA, and his group was noted for their enthusiastic support of the Iranian Revolution, their rejection of the Sunnah except where it agrees with their opinions, and the idea that women should be leaders of the Islamic movement. And they used to go to ISNA meetings in the early 80s and heckle the speakers because of their attitude toward women. Then you have Aziz al-Hibri and her protege, Amina Wadud Muhsin, who she also teaches at the University of Richmond, and I assume that she got there through Aziz al-Hibri. She did a doctoral thesis on, which was later printed in a shortened form as a book called Quran and Woman, or Woman and Quran, I forget. These people, the methodology that they use in dealing with Islamic sources is, first of all, a rejection of the Sunnah, either in whole or in part. And when dealing with the Quran, they use a technique that was pioneered, as far as I know, by Fazlur Rahman. Fazlur Rahman was a scholar who was basically driven out of Pakistan. He was so disliked for his opinion. And he was hired by the University of Chicago, and he has mentored a whole new generation of scholars or students of Islam here in America. And he wrote a book called Modernizing Islam, Confronting an Ancient Tradition, something like that. In there, he says, when you look at the Quran, you have to realize that it was revealed in a specific cultural milieu. So you have to take the specifics and extract the general from them, and then you have to reapply those general principles to your specific situation. So let me just give you an example of how they do that. Or first of all, one of the examples they use for it, in the verses of, in Surah Al-Anfal, which says, وَأَعِدُّ لَهُمْ مَا اسْتَطَعْتُمْ مِنْ قُوَّةٍ وَمِنْ رِبَاطِ الْخَيْرِ تُرْهِبُونَ بِهِ عَدُوَّ اللَّهِ وَعَدُوَّكُمْ. Prepare for them what you're able to of strength and stables of forces, striking fear thereby into the hearts of the enemies of Allah and your enemies. So it's mentioned there, stables of horses. Okay, in World War II, the Polish cavalry was cut to pieces by the German tanks in the Blitzkrieg. So it became quickly apparent that cavalry was not going to be very useful in modern mechanized warfare. So this verse was revealed to people in a certain technological era. And it doesn't mean that we're supposed to maintain a cavalry and neglect an air force and armored vehicles and stuff like that. So in this particular instance, the methodology is valid because there was a technological change. Okay, but they try to apply it to a verse like the verse that says, tell the Muslim women to lower their gaze and to guard their modesty and to let their khimars, وَلْيَضْرِبْنَ بِخُمْرِهِنَّ عَلَى جُيُوبِهِنَّ, let their khimars hang over their literally pockets, but the pocket in those days used to be on like some Moroccan soaps. Nowadays the pocket was on the center of the chest, so the khimar is supposed to cover the chest as well as the head, and the word khimar means something that covers the head. So this is very specific. Okay, is there some kind of a technological change that would make this obsolete? You know, a Klingon cloaking device or something like that? We don't have anything like that. So, is there some kind of change in the morals of the people where the morals have improved now so that you don't have to cover your hair and your chest? If you claim that, then you're saying that the people of this time are better than the Sahaba, and that's a very untenable position. So this style of argument is dangerous. Another way that Fazl Rahman uses it, and then Amina Wadud Mahsin copies him, in the issue of witnesses in financial transactions, there should be two men to witness it, and if there's only one man, then a man and two women. And he said, well, this was because in that time women didn't deal with commercial activities much, and therefore it made sense at that time. Nowadays women are fully acquainted with these types of business, so the requirement is no longer needed. This is a person who says that will have to be able to answer to Allah on the Day of Judgment if they're wrong. There's a basic rule in Islam that says there's no ijtihad permitted with a clear text. So you know, if he's able to present evidence, then he would be exonerated. But it is a dangerous thing. And, you know, there's some interesting stuff that happened, evidence from research recently. They're able to use CAT scans to check brain activity of people while they're alive. And there's a consistent gender difference between the way men and women use their brains in processing information. And, you know, which is better or worse is not for us to say, it's inconclusive. But, you know, this is reminiscent of the issue of, Allah mentioned inheritance. Your children and your parents, you don't know which of them is closer to you in benefit. So Allah is the one who laid down the inheritance laws, because He is the one who knows how to give everybody their due right. So when He gives a stipulation about, for instance, two women being required as witnesses in financial transactions, it's very dangerous for somebody afterwards to say that was for then and this is for now, because the Quran is for all time. And Allah said, Al-Yawma akmaltu lakum dinakum, today I've perfected, completed your religion for you. Time is short, so let me just get to two points of Amina with Ud Mohsin. First, to show the quality of the scholarship, which by and large is fairly careful, but she made a glaring error when quoting the verse of Surat An-Nisa, the first verse of Surat An-Nisa. She transliterates it thus: وَمِنْ آيَاتِهِ أَنْ خَلَقَكُمْ مِنْ نَفْسٍ وَاحِدَةٍ وَخَلَقَ مِنْهَا زَوْجَهَا وَبَثَّ مِنْهُمَا رِجَالًا كَثِيرًا وَنِسَاءً. This is not the way that verse is. She's blended the beginning of a verse from Surat Al-Rum with and tacked that onto the beginning of the end of the surah from Surat An-Nisa, the ayah from Surat An-Nisa. That's sloppy scholarship. But on a matter of approach or substance, she talks about this verse, الرجال قوامون على النساء. And this verse, it's specifically talking about the relation between husband and wife. And she says this verse has nothing to say about a woman obeying her husband. And she talks about the issue of qawwama, she talks about the issue of tafdeel. بِمَا فَضَّلَ اللَّهُ بَعْضَهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ. She says the preference mentioned here is only in one issue, perhaps two, that they're allowed to divorce their wife without seeking an outside authority, whereas the wife has to go to a judge, and that they get a double share of inheritance. Part of her methodology in her book is that she never mentions a hadith. The only place she mentioned a hadith is in the footnotes when she was talking about the ayah in Surat An-Nisa that I just previously mentioned, that that Allah created us from a single soul and created from it its mate. And she says, and I quote, "Is perhaps the scarcity of detail that has caused Quranic commentators like Az-Zamakhshari to rely on biblical accounts which state that Eve was extracted from the rib or side of Adam." Then in the notes she says, "Not to be overlooked, however, is a similar story in a hadith," plural of hadith, right? "All of which have a single link in their isnad, thus diminishing their strength." I mean, there's a multitude of these hadith. I mean, there's multiple isnads. Each of them might come down to a single narrator at some point in the isnad, but there's multiple isnads of this hadith, which says that women were created from a rib and the rib is curved. So she consistently ignores hadith. So just to mention one hadith on this issue, which is reported by Bukhari, Muslim, Ahmad, Ad-Darimi, Abu Dawood, Al-Tirmidhi, and Ibn Majah. It says the Prophet ﷺ went out after the Eid and he gave a special khutbah to the women. He said, "Ya ma'ashar al-nisa, tasaddaqna." O assembly of women, give charity. فَإِنِّي أُرِيتُكُمْ أَكْثَرَ أَهْلِ النَّارِ. Because I was shown you to be the majority of people in the fire. They said, "Why is that, Ya Rasulullah?" He said, "Takthurna al-la'n," and you're given to cursing frequently. "Watakthurna al-ashir," and you're ungrateful for good company. "ما رأيت من ناقصات عقل ودين أذهب للبد الرجل الحازم من إحداكن." Is that I haven't seen anyone deficient in intellect and deen who is more able to sway
a rajula that has, I mean, a person who has a firm grounding or whatever, to sway his mind than one of you. They said, and what is the deficiency in our deen and in our intellect, Ya Rasulullah? He said, isn't the shahada of a woman, the testimony of a woman, half the shahada of a man? They said, yes. He said, that is nuqsan in their, that's the deficiency in their intellect. And isn't it so that when one of them menstruates that she does not pray or fast? They said, yes. He said, that is the deficiency in their deen. So the starting point and the ending point in dealing with the issues of the Quran and the Sunnah, or the issues that face us in our life, is the verse from Surah Al-Nisa, Surah Al-Ahzab. وما كان لمؤمن ولا مؤمنة إذا قضى الله ورسوله أمرا أن يكون لهم الخيرة من أمرهم ومن يعص الله ورسوله فقد ضل ضلالا مبينا. It's not the right of a believing man or a believing woman, once Allah and His Messenger have decided an issue, that they should have a choice in that issue of theirs. And whoever disobeys Allah and His Messenger, then he has strayed openly. And as a methodology for understanding the Quran, this is clearly indicated in the verse of Surah Al-Hijr, وَأَنزَلْنَا إِلَيْكَ الذِّكْرَ لِتُبَيِّنَ لِلنَّاسِ مَا نُزِّلَ إِلَيْهِمْ وَلَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ. We sent down the reminder to you that you might explain to the people what was revealed to them, and that perchance they might reflect or think. So, a methodology which seeks to explain the Quran simply by linguistic means, analyzing the meanings of words, and completely ignores the statements of the Prophet in explaining those words, is going to be deficient. So this whole verse revolves around obedience of the woman to the man, and this obedience is not blind obedience. We know that Allah mentions making shura. The husband and wife have to make shura on the issue of weaning the child, or weaning the child before 2 years are finished. And the general description of the believers, وَأَمْرُهُمْ شُورَى بَيْنَهُمْ, that their affairs are conducted by consultation. But whenever there is a difference of opinion, then somebody has to have a tie-breaking vote. And when there's only two members in the group, the husband and the wife, Allah has given that tie-breaking vote to the man due to the shortness of time. I'll stop there. Okay, there's a question here. Could you please explain the supposed Islamic basis of circumcision for women, and are there specific steps or exceptions to this act? This is based on a number of hadith. One of them is reported by Abu Dawood, that the Prophet ﷺ told Umm Atiyah that and she used to perform female circumcision. He told her, according to this version, that she should cut a little bit and not eradicates the clitoris. And this particular hadith is weak in its isnad, but Sheikh Al-Albani, he brought a number of supporting hadith. All of them have problems in the isnad. In his book, Silsilat al-Hadith al-Sahiha, every single one of those hadith has a problem in the isnad. He says that when you put them all together, they become sahihun li ghayrihi, which I'm kind of amazed at that. I mean, maybe you can make a case for hasan li ghayrihi, but sahihun li ghayrihi. I think he's more knowledgeable than I am, but by a lot. But I was kind of surprised by that. However, there is one hadith which is very authentic, which is the hadith of Aisha radiallahu anha, that it's reported in the Sahihain. It's reported by virtually every book of hadith, not just the Sahihain, Bukhari and Muslim, that some scholars were debating about whether it's necessary to take the ghusl if there was intercourse but the man didn't ejaculate. So they deputed Abu Musa al-Ash'ari to go speak to him, and when he got there he was feeling shy to broach the topic, and she said, go ahead, I'm like your mother. And so then he asked her, and she said that the Prophet ﷺ said, إِذَا الْتَقَى الْخِتَانَانِ فَقَدْ وَجَبَ الْغُسْلِ. When the two circumcised parts meet, then the ghusl is obligatory. Okay, this is merely a statement of fact. You know, it's a passing reference to a circumcised part touching a circumcised part. So it implies that, or it indicates that it's something that they practiced in his day and that he did not forbid it. So to say it's haram is overstepping the limits. To say it's bid'ah is overstepping the limits. The scholars who approve of it, they put it in a place that's lower than sunnah. They say it's makrama, for the it's a gracing of the woman if she wants to do it. So however, the practice of the Sudanese and the Egyptians and some other people of cutting away the labia majora and minora, and sewing the vagina shut and things like that, these are completely forbidden. The maximum that could be done is clipping the tip of the clitoris. Allahu a'lam. We have 7 minutes. Sometime, inshallah, I was wondering if you could help me. I've been reading Bukhari and I just wanted to know that the story behind one hadith regarding Hawa. Hadith said something like, if it wasn't for the Jews, heat would not go bad, and if it weren't for Hawa, women wouldn't deceive their husbands. I don't know much regarding this. Allahu a'lam. Yeah. I don't know anything about it. We have emphasized a lot about what the role of women is not. Audience are at different stages of knowledge. I wish you can explain about the general role of women in Islam, even more how to avoid the feminist women movements. Please give us some references to which we can refer to. So on topic, the first of all, you know, the basic rule is that everybody has spiritual duties, and the spiritual status and duties of women are comparable to men. من عمل صالحا من ذكر أو أنثى وهو مؤمن لنحيينهم حياة طيبة. I forgot the end of the verse. It says, whoever does a good deed from a man or a woman and is a believer, then we will make them to live a good life, and we will give them a reward in the hereafter according to the best of what they used to do. So the first duties of a woman are like the duties of any Muslim, which is to know Allah, to know about the deen of Allah, to practice the fara'id of worship, then, you know, certainly a primary role of women in society is as wives and mothers. I mean, that's been the traditional role, and it's an indispensable role for the continuation of the species. And it is, you know, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in one version of that hadith about the sajda, he said, by Allah, a woman can't fulfill her duty to Allah until she fulfills her duty to her husband. So the you know, these are the primary roles. If women don't do them, then the especially child raising will be handed over to people who are not emotionally involved in those children. So the kind of care that they're going to get will be deficient. For sure, in America, you have lots of women who accept Islam. They don't have Muslim families. Maybe they get married, maybe they get divorced. Some women have been divorced 2-3 times. They have children. You know, these women have big problems, and you know, in situations like that, you know, she might need to work. She should try to find work that would be in a place where she doesn't have to have a lot of contact with men. Can you please put it simply, is Islam a patriarchal religion? Well, the point is, are we going to take the terminology of a people whose starting point is not our belief and use it to define ourselves? So that's a very central issue. The gender feminists, their deen is feminism. Okay, it has taken the place of religion for them, the way that environmentalism is the deen of some of the more radical environmentalists. So, you know, it's beyond that. I mean, I don't want to reply to it. Time is over. So, Hanukkah, Allahumma bihamdika, ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta, astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk.